This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Today, our special guest is Australian singer-songwriter Pete Murray. 10 years ago, his debut album, Feeler, went on to sell 500,000 copies and really put him on the Australian music industry map. Today, he's touring and playing the songs from that album to celebrate 10 years since its release. Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review talks about the future of Qantas, while Bourke farmer Ian Cole expresses his concerns about the drought that is really hitting the bush hard. Ben McKechnie, our film reviewer, has not much time for A Winter's Tale. He says the best thing about it was the free popcorn. And Anglican Aid CEO David Mansfield explains the challenge that they've just completed 100 beaches in 10 days. And we catch up with Luke Doherty from Sky News Sport for a wrap of the Winter Olympics. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. In 2003, Pete Murray's debut album, Feeler, rocketed up the Aussie charts to number one. It went on to sell more than 500,000 copies, and his next two albums also achieved number one status. A decade later, Pete Murray has released a 10-year anniversary edition of Feeler, backed up by a national tour. G'day, Pete.
Hello.
Good to talk to you today. Does it feel like it's been 10 years?
Yeah, you know, it's a long time, but it doesn't feel like it is for me because I've been so busy. And, you know, when you're so busy, everything's sort of just cruises along pretty quickly.
So. It's sped up, yeah. My first memory of your music, Pete, was going to a gig at the Bridge Hotel. You were playing with a little-known support act, a young girl by the name of Missy Higgins. Did you have a sense then that you're on the cusp of making it big?
Back then, I probably wasn't too sure, but I think I was just having fun, you know. It was just good getting out with the band. And no, I didn't really have any idea that was going to happen. And,
yeah,
you know, to the success that it was as well. I even remember doing a couple of months later, we came back and we did the first show of the tour was at Bar Broadway, which was 400 capacity. And that's when it was just kind of madness. And, you know, there was people lined up down the street that were trying to get in. And,
you know, and that was sort of the first sign that, hey, this is really going someplace.
That's the first time, yeah. I kind of thought to myself, you know, hey, yeah, this might actually work.
So. Awesome. It did have a very distinctive kind of sound to it, I guess. And maybe as a new artist breaking out, maybe that's what you need to get known.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was very different at the time when that came out and really stood out from everything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember a lot of pop or pop rock
was
kind of the big thing, really. The English bands were doing a lot of that pop rock.
The English boy bands, really, yeah.
And that was kind of, you know, had the whole airwaves were full of that stuff. So when this came out, I think it was kind of like a breath of fresh air for people, and everyone's like, wow, what's this? You know, it's really different. I think even the record label got them by surprise too, because they were playing this album and a couple of other albums for the new artists to the radio stations and the press and all media. And the response that they were getting from my album was, like they said, we couldn't believe it. They had a goal of selling maybe 25,000 copies for this album. And, you know, it ended up going over 500,000, so
yeah.
Which was a little bit above what their expectations were. So, you know, I think they were caught by surprise too. And when it took off, which is a nice surprise.
Yeah. Now, you're celebrating 10 years since then. And 10 years is really a long time in the music business. A lot of artists have come and gone in that time. Do you think you'll still be doing this in another 10 years?
Well, that's the goal, you know. Like, I mean, for me, I'd like to be doing it, you know, for the rest of my life. So having that longevity is a really hard thing, and I have a lot of respect for artists and bands that can manage to stay around for a long time, because it's, you do see, you know, the next biggest thing comes along and it's massive and then suddenly it's just gone.
Yeah.
Writing music that's, you're not trying to stick with the fashion and, you know, write songs that can live with people for the rest of their life, I think is a really important thing too.
Yeah. Look, what's the next step for Pete Murray? Can we expect to see you popping up as a judge on X Factor anytime soon?
No, I don't think so. I don't really watch those shows. So, I don't know. I'm not a super big fan of it. So one positive thing is that it does get a lot of people the exposure that they don't have. You know, the unfortunate thing is with that, I guess they've got to be tagged with that for the rest of their life too. And they'll battle that, and that can be a negative thing for them, and they may never shake it. It's not very credible, and I think that if you do it the credible way, it's kind of just doing it yourself and building that following up, I think that you know, you will have more longevity too.
Well, before I let you go, what's your favourite Pete Murray song?
You know, Feel is a really great song to play live. It's just kind of nice and cruisy at the start, and then gets kind of to a big epic ending and a big kind of a rocket ending. So that's probably the most fun. I think it really grooves well and kind of party at the end.
Okay, well, I'll play that in just a minute. But I know, look, you're about to do some shows, and I know that your shows in South Australia, Perth, Brisbane and Newcastle have sold out, but are there still tickets to the Sydney show at the Enmore?
Yeah, but not many. I think they're selling really fast too now. Pretty much all city shows have sold out except for Sydney, and all the regional ones that we put on have just been going really well too. So I think it's been touching a quarter of people, this album, and getting back out there and playing it again. So, yeah, there's tickets left, but I don't know how many.
All right. Thank you. That's Pete Murray. He has just embarked on his Feeler 10-year anniversary tour. He's playing March 28 at the Enmore Theatre. But if you want tickets, you'll need to be quick. Let's have a little listen to Pete Murray's favourite Pete Murray song. This is Feeler on Hope 103.2. So we've all been hearing how Qantas has been struggling as a company, as recent job cuts have shown, and the federal government is now considering throwing them a lifeline. To talk more about this, I'm joined by Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review. Hi, Kai.
Good morning.
So what's the government considering at the moment?
So, Katrina, they're considering two options. And so the first one is a debt guarantee, potentially. Our sources say that this is something that could provide short-term relief. In fact, many within the government reportedly see it as inevitable that the government will have to provide a debt guarantee, which basically means that if for some reason Qantas were to not be able to pay its debt back, the government or the taxpayer would shell out instead. And what that means is that Qantas is able to borrow at lower rates mm-hmm. than they otherwise would have. So that helps them out financially. And the other half of it is Qantas wants to change the Qantas Sale Act. They want Parliament to repeal the Qantas Sale Act that keeps the company Australian controlled. And so those are the two main angles that the government is looking in terms of providing what they say, what Tony Abbott says, is just simply levelling the playing field alongside the likes of, say, Virgin.
Okay, so Tony Abbott's very much in favour of allowing Qantas to be opened up to, I guess, more foreign investment. But what are some of the potential risks of that?
Certainly, there's always going to be somewhat of a national security concern by many people. Now, some people don't believe there is a national security concern. They point to other airlines around the world. And I mean, if you take Virgin, for example, I mean, that is owned almost in a way by another government, because Singapore Airlines has such a huge stake in them. Of course, Singapore Airlines is backed by their government. However, there's concerns that it could lead to a carve-up of Qantas. So if, in other words, if you open it up to overseas raiders, some of them might be quite ruthless. And for example, the regional operations of Qantas, which are very important for people that live in country areas, they could disappear potentially, so says the opposition, because mm-hmm. what private investor would want to prop something like that up? It's really an issue of, do we want Qantas in its current form, or are we willing to potentially see it get carved up?
Yeah, and I suppose it is a bit of a unique business in the sense of our Australian geography presents us with a few challenges. Why are companies like Virgin then able to be competitive and do well, and yet our Qantas can't?
Yes, well, it's interesting to see Richard Branson has stepped in yet again to basically say if Qantas... back in December, he'd said, if Qantas were better managed and offered the public a decent service, it wouldn't be in the financial claims it is.
Right.
And on the weekend, he took out full-page newspaper ads saying that if Qantas were helped by the government, that business people worldwide, so international investors, would think twice about coming here because the government could step in to help the local boy. So Virgin, as we've touched on already, is backed by state-backed airlines. It's majority owned by Etihad in New Zealand and Singapore Airlines. And so, as I mentioned, Tony Abbott is simply saying, look, that's fine for Virgin. They've got the cashed-up shareholders and they're competing very aggressively. It's all good. But Qantas is shackled by this Sale Act and presents the national carrier with a lot of difficulty.
When are they going to be making any kind of decision about this? Because I assume that sounds like Tony Abbott is pushing to change his legislation.
Yes, well, look, a lot of this comes on the back of some terrible financial results for Qantas, not surprisingly.
Okay.
$300 million loss has been flagged back in December by Qantas. 1,000 jobs are going to go. In fact, I know some people who are you know, that have taken redundancies at Qantas, and some friends that are facing yet another round of compulsory redundancies now that the voluntary round has gone by. So it's a very real issue for Qantas, and it seems that the government, according to our sources, is going to wait till after February 27, and that's when Qantas is scheduled to release its half-year results. And to be honest, a lot of people are expecting those, as Qantas flagged last year, to be an absolute shocker.
Oh, so if they're so bad, then there'll be sort of support that they have to do something, I suppose.
Yeah. Look, there's nothing like an announcement, you know, they're likely to confirm, you know, a hefty loss. It might even be worse than the $300 million they flagged previously. But there's nothing like job losses, and especially, you know, when you're talking in the order of thousands, to help from the political point of view to push through something as radical as removing the Qantas Sale Act, because, you know, of course, Qantas has been under that act since the beginning.
All right. Well, thank you, Kai, for filling us in on some of this detail.
You're welcome, Katrina.
That's Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review talking about some of the struggles that our national airline Qantas has been facing recently. Tony Abbott was touring drought-affected areas on the weekend to see for himself the impact that the lack of rain has had on primary producers. And he was in Bourke over the weekend, and local Bourke farmer Ian Cole had a bit of a taste of the action. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hi, Katrina. How are you today?
Yeah, not too bad. You guys seem to get a lot of high-profile visitors. I know the Queen's been to Bourke. A lot of politicians like to go there. What did you want the PM to take away from his visit?
Well, yeah, we do get a lot of high-profile visitors, and it was good to see Tony Abbott here. He certainly has put the drought on the national agenda. I see that there's been quite a bit of press coverage last night and this morning, and it's all positive.
What did you want him to, I guess, learn from the visit?
Oh, well, I think we wanted him to learn that that things are pretty crook out in the bush, particularly northwestern New South Wales, where the drought has been spreading. And, you know, we've had a problem here for a couple of years now. Previous to that, we'd had several good seasons with lots of rains and even floods in the rivers. But, you know, it seems to have all dried up again, and we seem to have been going back to, you know, the millennium drought between, you know, early 2000 and, say, 2 through to 2009, where we had a huge drought that really did a lot of damage economically and socially in the bush and environmentally, of course, as well.
So are you really sort of still recovering from that period? It's not so long ago?
A lot of people are still recovering from that. I mean, a lot of equity was taken out of businesses during that drought, and people were just starting to try and build up again. But, you know, that takes some years. And, you know, farmers are hopeful people. They look at the weather and they see it's not good, and they think, oh, well, next year will be a better year. And when it isn't, they think, oh, well, we'll have a look at next year. They tend to hang on, but quite a lot have, you know, left the bush, know, since I've known the Bourke area, which is virtually all my life. And look, things were starting to get really serious again, where graziers, for example, were paying, you know, over $500 a tonne for feed for their sheep and cattle, where, you know, sheep and cattle were dying, where people were trying to get adjustment and couldn't, where people are starting to cart water and so on and so forth. So Tony Abbott's visit was good for two things. First of all, he did bring the rain to Bourke, although you could say it was just a coincidence.
Yeah, well, that might make him a little bit popular, mightn't it?
It was quite funny to arrive out at Jandra and to have a sweltering hot day with lots of humidity, which is abnormal out here, but lots of humidity and flies all over people. And, you know, we were standing in the wool shed waiting for him. It was very oppressive. And as soon as he got into the wool shed, got up on a stump and started talking, the rain just bucketed out of the skies. You know, we'd had cloudy weather all morning, and I was looking at it thinking it's not going to rain, but it did.
Yeah, wow.
And you know, we all heard Tony Abbott, but for the speeches after that, it was very difficult to hear what he had to say because of the sound on a tin roof. You'd know all about that.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
You just
definitely
hear some of the speeches. I mean, we partly heard Barnaby Joyce and the local member Mark Colton, but it was great to see. We had to close all the shutters in the wool shed because people were getting wet from the rain, and there were kids running out in the rain who probably had never seen rain like that before.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what would you like to see announced in the drought assistance package that they're currently putting together?
Tony Abbott said this is, you know, not a thing that's going to be a long-term thing, and it can't be. I mean, it's like any other natural disaster, a drought. It's like a flood or a fire or whatever, and so some support is needed. I'd like to see, you know, the federal government look at the proposals put up by the New South Wales Farmers and the National Farmers Federation on loan support for people who need it, on income support, mm-hmm. where people are really doing it hard and finding it hard to put bread on the table. And there are people like that. It's surprising how many people live in poverty in the bush.
Yeah.
And no one's ever, you know, it must be decades since anyone's done an inquiry into poverty in the bush, but it's certainly there. And people are in need. Tony Abbott said it was, you know, the package he'd put together would be appropriate and fiscally responsible. So those sorts of things are what's needed. We need to make sure also that people can continue to employ the people that they have in work and address some of the social and economic needs in the towns. And to that end, I think, you know, businesses in towns like Bourke and Walgett and Brewarrina and other places affected by drought throughout the country do need some help at the moment.
Well, thanks very much, Ian, for filling us in a little bit on what's happening in the bush right now.
Okay, thanks, Katrina.
That's Ian Cole, Bourke farmer, who's been touring around with Tony Abbott a little bit over the weekend. Film reviewer Ben McKechnie has been along to Winter's Tale, a magical romance starring Colin Farrell, Jessica Brown-Findlay from Downton Abbey and Russell Crowe. Hi, Ben.
Good morning to you. How's things?
Not too bad. What's the premise of this movie, Ben?
Well, you're right. It is a magical romance. That's definitely the concept. The premise, it's very difficult to describe within a couple of sentences.
Okay. But
basically, this is like a love story set across many different centuries. And it's also about angels and miracles and magic and light and the universe and good and bad and devils in the form of Russell Crowe and other famous actors and many other things besides.
So it sounds rather convoluted.
Well, that's a polite word for Winter's Tale, convoluted. This film really wants to be magical, and it really wants to kind of draw you into its spell, and it's effectively presenting a description of the universe, or like how our world works. It really feels like a movie trying to describe how our world works in terms of everything from miracles to love to purpose to meaning, and puts it in this story, which for my wife and I, Amy and I, we were just both rolling our eyes and bored all the way through is probably the best way to describe Winter's Tale.
Okay. So, I mean, I saw on Rotten Tomatoes it scored 15%. So where would you say it's going wrong?
I think where it's going wrong is that it's got so many various elements in this movie. And as you mentioned in the intro, Colin Farrell and Jessica Finlay-Brown from Downton Abbey are in this, and they're kind of playing star-crossed lovers. And the story of their love affair is set in this kind of context of people ultimately becoming stars in the sky, and on the way there they have to find their purpose, and that seems to be within love, but who's really sure? And then Russell Crowe's trying to chase Colin Farrell down as this New York Irish demon guy, trying to stop him from doing his thing. And where it's going wrong, I think, is it's taking too seriously what really is overall quite silly. I'm not just trying to have a go at people, you know, having a shot at trying to explain the universe. It's actually quite remarkable the lengths they've gone in this movie to try to explain what's going on in the world we live in. But I think the downside is that there's so much talk of really quite preposterous stuff that when they present it on screen, it just comes off as laughable. And I think that's what's crushed Winter's Tale, is it can't bring the romance or the love above how kind of silly the whole thing is.
So you just couldn't take it seriously by the sounds of things.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I should also point out, look, I'm a bloke, but B, I'm a bloke who actually doesn't mind romantic comedies and romantic dramas. Like, I'm not just a hater who's going in there to try to smash, like, romance off the screen. But, you know, it's a movie, and it's actually inviting you into its world. And at the very least, you should be able to buy into it. Mm-hmm. Even if there's stuff that you kind of, like, go, oh, whatever, or that's a bit daft, or I don't know how all of that adds up. You should be able to buy into it. So, like a movie like Enchanted, you know that movie with Amy Adams, that kind of fairy tale concept of her coming from like Disneyland into the real world. You know, it's ridiculous, but it's actually enjoyable and entertaining. Winter's Tale, on the other hand, apart from some big name cameos and some very curious ideas about the universe and how the universe looks after people in the face of a seeming tussle between good and evil, it really raises some big issues that are fantastic to talk about and really seek answers for, but the answers that Winter's Tale provides are just, I'm laughing just thinking about it.
So it sounds like it's not even worth watching just for entertainment value. It's probably one just to give it a complete miss.
I would say so, yes. Given the concept of the universe that they're presenting in this movie, if they were presenting it like even like a few degrees more entertainingly, with less dumb dialogue, less, like, it's got some stupid lines in this movie. There's just not much I can say positive to actually drag you through this movie, apart from, well, we had some free popcorn when we were there, so enjoy that.
Ben, we'll put you out of your misery. I don't think we should talk about this for even a second longer.
Katrina, please, let's never speak about this movie again. And hopefully when next we speak, it'll be a much more positive review from me.
You need to have one of those things done, like from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where they just erase it out of your brain forever.
Oh, but like, we can finally end on a positive note of this conversation, Katrina. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is a fantastic film about relationships that you look at what's going on in that film and think this is preposterous and it never could happen, but it doesn't matter because the way the movie presents its case is so engaging and enriching, and you've got so many concepts coming out of it you want to talk about, like I just want to talk about now, but I need to wrap up. Eternal Sunshine, Spotless Mind, awesome. Winter's Tale, not even close.
Okay, thank you, Ben.
My pleasure.
Ben McKechnie talking about Winter's Tale. It stars Colin Farrell and Russell Crowe, and Ben McKechnie will never again be sitting through it. Over the past 9 days, seven very eager surfers have been hitting the water 10 times a day for the 100 Beaches Challenge, starting at Boilie Point on the south coast last week and finishing at Barrenjoey on Sydney's northern beaches today. The team will have surfed 100 beaches in 10 days to raise $1 million to fight poverty. David Mansfield is the CEO of Anglican Aid, and he's been hitting both the water and the speaking circuit every day for the past 10 days. Hi, David.
Good morning, Katrina.
Where are you right now?
We're at Bungan Beach, right up on the northern beaches. So this is beach number 93.
Ah, I have never actually even heard of that beach, just showing my ignorance there.
I haven't been here for 40 years.
Is that right? And is it looking pretty much the same as it did 40 years ago or not?
I can't remember.
All right. 100 beaches in 10 days. Whose crazy idea was that?
It was my idea. Last year, a group of us rode 2,500 kilometres to central Queensland and back to break the cycles of poverty, as we called it then. And I thought, well, next time I do something, I don't want to ride a bike. My backside was too sore. And so I decided...
So this was all just what suits you, really, David?
Well, I wanted to do something different and appeal to people who may love the beach and surfing. And I think it's got to do with the fact that we just enjoy so many magnificent beaches on the east coast of New South Wales, and, well, all of Australia, really. And it's a wonderful way of being out in God's creation and at the same time thinking of those who live in such grinding poverty throughout the world and can't enjoy what we enjoy.
David, you're so right that going to the beach is a good way to kind of feel blessed and to realise, you know, just how very blessed we are in this beautiful country. Between the seven surfers that you had, you have an average age of 53, I noticed. So I have to ask you about this. How are the old joints and the muscles feeling, David, for you bunch of old guys?
Well, most of us are in our early 60s, and one of us is 17 years of age. So he single-handedly lowered the average age to 53.
Love it, yeah.
We're feeling pretty tired, pretty sore. We're going about things very slowly at this point than we were on the first day, I can assure you.
Has the weather been kind to you the last 10 days?
The weather's been pretty good. We had rain on Wednesday when we were in the eastern suburbs beaches, but that was fine. Today there's a southerly come through, and that makes things quite cool. But generally the weather's been really good.
So what have been the biggest challenges for you over the past 10 days?
Oh, one of the biggest challenges has been getting to the next beach right on the hour, because local people have been coming out to pray with us. We pray for the first 10 minutes from the top of the hour, and then we go for a surf, and then we race off to the next beach as quickly as we can. And sometimes there's a fair bit of travelling. Now that we're in suburban Sydney, the travelling's not so far. But getting to that next beach on top of the hour, just in case people have come out to meet us and pray with us, has been a challenge, especially if the waves have been good and we want to stay in the water.
And you can't drag yourself away.
That's right. Yeah.
But listen, it hasn't been all surfing for you, has it? You've also been speaking at churches every night about the work of your organisation, Anglican
That's
Aid.
Right.
So yes. What do you want people to know about what you do?
Well, each night we've been having dinners and coffee and dessert nights at local churches, and we've been talking about the various partnerships that Anglican Aid is involved with Christian leaders in different parts of Africa and Asia. Our partners aren't just Anglican. They are Christian leaders from a range of backgrounds, but they are serving their communities no matter what the religious persuasion of people in their communities are. So our Christian partner, for example, in India, is working amongst largely Hindu people, providing eye health, doing simple cataract operations for them, and serving everyone in the community, the most needy in the community. We've got a wonderful project in the southwest of Ethiopia. When I say wonderful, it's heartbreaking,
yeah,
but it's so important to be a part of. In that part of the world, children are dying at a higher rate than anywhere else in the world. 91 infant deaths per 1,000 births, and that's as high as anywhere in the world. And it's really got to do with a need for families and for mothers to understand the importance of sanitation and hygiene. And our project there is literally saving hundreds of lives.
And this is one of the main projects you're actually raising money for, isn't it, as part of what you're doing? You're raising money for that project in Ethiopia.
Yeah, the Gambela Wash Sanitation Hygiene Project is one project that we think is very, very important. Another one is we're educating kids in Bali from very impoverished rural communities in Bali.
Okay, great. Well,
Bali
sounds like...
and Australia have a certain affinity, obviously, and yet behind the tourist strip in Bali, there are many people living in poverty and families who can't afford to educate their children.
Well, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the work that you're doing, and I really hope you have a great time surfing your last 10 beaches today, David.
Thanks, Katrina. Thank you so much for the opportunity of sharing with you and your listeners.
No, you're very welcome. That's David Mansfield. He's the CEO of Anglican Aid. They are just hours away from finishing their 100 Beaches Challenge. And if you'd like to support the work they do at Anglican Aid, you can make a donation at anglicanaid.org.au or phone 1800 653 903. That's 1800 653 903.
Hope 1032 Mornings, talking sport with Luke Doherty.
Hey, Luke.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm feeling rotten today, Luke. I have a cold, so you have to be my pick-me-up, okay? I'm relying on you to put me into a better mood and make me feel better this morning. Yeah, no pressure. Have you got some good news about the cricket?
Yeah, it's all great news. Look, it's not too bad at the moment. I think if you picked up the papers or you read most of the news headlines this morning, you think Australia had pretty much already won the second test after the first day. Look, I love optimism. I think it's great, and this Australian team is really needed to be optimistic because they really have come from a long way back to be where they are now, the third-ranked nation in the world, and really giving the first-ranked test nation in South Africa a good run for their money. But we have to remember that we came off a 3-0 Ashes loss. We came off a 4-0 drubbing in India as well. We did extremely well against what was a pretty poor England side in Australia, and we're 1-0 up in this series. That's great. But I think the headlines this morning are a little bit misleading in the fact that if you read them, you would have thought that Australia, as I said, was all over them.
Yeah, that we'd almost wrapped it up already after day one.
And it's 5 for 200-odd after the first day, which, you know, on a pitch like they've got at St George's in Port Elizabeth at the moment in South Africa, anything over 300 is going to be a pretty good score for your first inning. South Africa goes back to the crease tonight from 7:30 Sydney time, and if they pile on another 60, 70 runs, that's not a bad first innings total. And then Australia's top order, which has been pretty shaky as of late, barring a few decent performances by individuals each innings, what we haven't had is a consistent performance right across the board, things could look pretty shaky. So it's looking good, but it's not, you know, let's pop the champagne corks already and celebrate a series win over the first-ranked nation in the world. There's a long way to go tonight. There's a long way to go over the next couple of days. But
all right,
it could be worse.
So maybe take a chill pill at the moment instead of claiming.
Relax for a couple of days, breathe, put your feet up, get the pizza out, watch tonight and enjoy what's going on, but know there's a long way to go.
All right. Now, something that doesn't have a long way to go is the Winter Olympics. It's wrapping up and it looks like we're only going to finish with 2 or 3 medals.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting one. I mean, the debate's been raised in the last couple of days about how much money has been invested in this Australian Winter Olympic team and for the return that we've gotten. It's worked out. I think the figure was something like $6.7 million a medal or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think it's misleading to sort of look at it in that way. First of all, as a nation, we have to decide what's important to us and what we want to excel at, because there's only a certain amount of money in the funding pie. Mm. And even the Summer Olympic sports, which is, you know, you'd have to say is our bread and butter, they're having to more target medal funding. They're having to give more funding to the people that are more realistic chances of getting medals, and then cut back the funding in some of the sports that we're really never going to medal at. Mm-hmm. So I think the figure was $20 million was being used to fund this Olympic team. 9.5 of that was actually taxpayer-funded money. So the big outcry of, oh, we're, you know, we're funding people, you and I and the rest of the public are funding people to finish 40th or whatever, is only half true.
Okay.
You're still,
yep,
inclined to feel that way. But I think we really need to decide as a country and as the Australian Sports Commission and all of that, what we want to excel at, and then use that money to best target that. There's been some encouraging performances. Yes, we've won, you know, not the same amount of medals that we thought we were going to win, but we've upped our appearances in the top 10, and we've upped our appearances in the top 16 as well, which for a nation which, let's face it, doesn't have much snow to speak of.
No, not really.
Not too bad. But again, as I said, there's only a certain amount of money to go around. Is it better used elsewhere? I think that's a real, an important debate that the Australian Sports Commission and those who love Australian sport and in charge of the funding pie have to have.
Yeah, well, look, the thing is too, there was no gold in there. People do like to see a little bit of shiny gold, don't they?
Yeah, exactly right. I think we need to adjust our, again, adjust our expectations heading to a winter game. Summer Olympics, fine, go nuts, let your optimism run wild.
Mm.
Because, well, you know, we should be medalling and finishing up there on the medal tally. The Winter Olympics, if you make a semi-final or a quarter-final, that's pretty good considering the hurdles that some of our Winter Olympic athletes have to go through. They train, you know, on ski ramps and jump into a lake instead of landing on snow. They push a bobsleigh along a running track instead of down ice.
Yeah.
You know, it's not great when you've got I think the stat the other day was our women's bobsleigh team with Astrid Rajenovic and Jana Pittman, the former Summer Olympic hurdler.
Mm.
She said that their whole campaign over the 4 years was funded by $70,000, whereas the British had something like $3.4 million.
Right.
It's just the gaps that we're looking at there. It's astonishing.
But, and the
know,
British...
You can look at those performances and feel proud if they make a semi or something like that.
Absolutely. I was going to say, the British have a slightly closer proximity to, you know, European snowfields and things like that.
Right,
as well.
Which you can just jump on the channel.
That's
exactly
right. That's right. Do you think, like, before we go, do you think Aussies really care about the Winter Olympics? Have people actually been tuning in to watch it?
Look, that's a funny question, isn't it? I think they take a passing interest. I'm not sure if it's, you know, stay up to all hours of the night like you would to see, you know, someone like Sally Pearson if she made the final and was running for gold like she was in London. I don't think it has that type of appeal yet.
Yeah.
To the winter sports, the people who live near snow, it's the most important thing in the world. The people in Jindabyne who were cheering, you know, till they were hoarse for Russ Henshaw and guys like that. You know, it is. It's a big deal. But I think for the majority of Australians, I think, you know, there's definitely a passing interest, but I don't think it generates that same sort of inbred passion that we have for the Summer Olympics, where we're cheering swimmers and athletes and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the way that I feel. Thanks, Luke, for sharing with us your thoughts today.
It's always a pleasure, mate.
Yeah, it's Luke Doherty from Sky News Sport.